Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to the show every Thursday at 11 on heritageradionetwork.org or download the podcast at iTunes. Today I have a very special guest who's in from the West Coast, Rena Tom. One of the things I talk about on these shows is the importance of having a mentor, a support system, and a business owner that you can talk to about your business. And for me, Rena has been all of those and a very true friend for as long as I can remember. I've watched her tackle everything from jewelry design and shop ownership to retail consulting and the founding of an amazing organization called Makeshift. Through all these changes, she's managed to tackle each project with grace and some serious skills. So Rena, thank you for being here. It is an honor to have you.
Thank you, Grace.
And thank you for being here despite taking a red eye this morning.
I'm going to be a little loopy today.
And also with Rena is her friend and architect, Brian Boyer, who will be talking to us later in the show about the expansion of Makeshift to the East Coast. So thanks for being here, Brian.
My pleasure.
So I want to start in the beginning. I read, even though I've known you for a really long time, I read a bajillion interviews with you with other sites to see what sort of questions you've been asked before. And not a lot of people have talked about your upbringing, which is always the first thing I start with. And I think of you as such a West Coast girl. So I want to start out with tell people where you're from and what your family was like growing up.
Okay. I'm from Sacramento. I am born and bred Californian. My family's been there for 4 or 5 generations. So I'm definitely a West Coast girl. And my folks are very much into entrepreneurship. My parents had a drapery store growing up, so I used to play with bolts of fabric and mini blinds and weird things like that. And my siblings have all, at one point or the other, owned their own businesses as well. So that was always something that I saw my family doing and that it could be something that I would want to do too. So while I've had full-time jobs, it's never really stuck with me.
How many siblings do you have?
I have 3.
That's, and they've all owned a business at some point.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. I don't think that's very common in most people's families. Does anybody in your family own a business, Brian?
My dad was a serial entrepreneur and actually also owned a drapery business.
Yeah. Oh,
what?
Really?
No way.
And you didn't know that, Rena.
I didn't know that. Hmm.
Crazy mini blind connection happening there. I think that's fascinating. In terms of growing up in a family that's relatively large, did you feel the need to like do anything to stand out from those siblings?
You know what? I was so much younger than them. I did stand out. I was the annoying little sister. So I don't think so. I got a lot of time by myself because of the big age difference. And mm-hmm. so I just learned to take care of myself, I guess, and make, you know, figure out resources and figure out what I wanted to do. And my folks were really encouraging for me to do what I wanted to try, you know, so.
What did you think you were going to do when you were little?
Something with roller coasters. Because I don't like them so much. And that kind of led into me getting a degree in mechanical engineering.
Oh, wow. And does that tie into the very... Rena has a very awesome roller coaster tattoo.
Yeah. So there's not that many roller coaster engineers in this country, unfortunately. That never happened. But I love things that excite people, I guess. And mechanical stuff. So that's my thing.
So how did you decide where you were going to go to school?
I wanted to stick around in California and I didn't want to be too close to home. I think a lot of people, you know, figure that out. And fortunately, it's a really big state, so you can have both of those things. And I ended up at Santa Barbara. They had a really nice engineering program and the atmosphere, of course, is beautiful. I was far enough away from home, but I can get back in a drive. I'm tired. I'm losing it. Like a 5-hour drive. And then... it was also really chill. I like a very relaxed atmosphere. I'm not terribly competitive at all. So I had looked at other places that, you know, like Berkeley, where the programs were very insane and everyone's kind of competing against each other. And that's really not what I'm into. I'd rather work with people.
Do you think that, that's sort of a subconscious way of you balancing? Like, you have an insane drive to do things. That's one of the things I most, like, strongly associate with you is this, like, ability to get things done. Do you think you're, like, always trying to put yourself in a city that's calm to balance that out? To me, San Francisco is pretty mellow.
San Francisco is pretty mellow. My big drive to do things, I think, came about when I lived in Brooklyn. Because everyone here has a giant drive to do like five things at once. And that's where I started Rare Device, the first one, because I saw everyone doing really great things. I'm like, I can do that. Sure, I can do that too. And then it got a little overwhelming for me and I did move back home, but I brought that drive with me. And so now I think I just look exceedingly busy to most Californians, but I'm pretty normal in New York terms.
Let's talk about how you made the transition to New York. What brought you from California to New York originally?
It was me and my husband. He got into grad school up at Columbia. And so we decided to sell our place in California and move out and give it a shot and see how well New York resonated with us.
Had you ever lived in New York before?
No.
What was your first impression being a full-time resident?
Oh my gosh. I think that a lot of the things I took for granted were a little bit harder and I would have to be pushier. You know, so the convenience factor is both higher in some regards, like all the delivery services and things like that, and then lower in others, like trying to get your utilities set up and your packages delivered.
Yes.
So kind of finding the balance between both of those things and the pace, you know, is crazy.
And so where did Rare Device come from that? For people who aren't familiar with Rena, she opened an incredible store that was sort of home goods and art and jewelry in Park Slope, Brooklyn, called Rare Device. Talk about how did that start?
Rare Device started because I was making jewelry in my apartment in Brooklyn, and Derek was in architecture school, and architecture school means studio, and studio means not ever being at home. So basically we moved, and then he said, oh, I gotta go to school now, and then I was there in my house by myself, and I didn't know anybody, and it was really, really crazy and tough, so I had to push pretty hard to get the jewelry business going, to meet other designers in the neighborhood and things like that. And I guess doing the store came about because I wasn't finding my friends' work in stores. And I just wanted to help everybody out. And I thought, I'll give it a shot. And if it doesn't work out, you know, school is over in a couple years. And then I can say, oh, it didn't work. And I can go home, basically.
Did Rare Device start before Etsy was founded? Or was that kind of concurrent at the same time?
I think it was the same year. I think it's 2005.
Because it's interesting. I associate those two things together because for me, I was living in Park Slope and that was how I first met you. Mm-hmm. And that your store in particular felt like such an interesting hotbed of like where to find new designers who hadn't been written about, who hadn't received major attention, and Etsy wasn't quite built up yet. And I thought stores were still the place to find things. And your store, even till when you decided to sell it in 2011? 2011, it was still a place to find things that you hadn't seen online. How were you finding the people and the things that you were putting in Rare Device?
I can't remember. I think on the internet a lot. I was just scouting a lot. I've always done lots and lots of looking around, and I was very comfortable doing that. I used to do web design and things, so being on the internet was not a scary thing to me. And I just searched and basically picked up whatever I liked and figured out how to get it from people. And at that point, you really had to hunt down who had it, find a phone number or an email, and just negotiate with them. There was no finding these folks at trade shows or anything else like that. So I just sort of pursued them.
Were you intimidated at all starting that shop? Had you ever worked in a shop before?
No.
So you thought, I'm going to open what has got to be one of the toughest niche businesses to run in like the toughest city
to run
in.
Yeah, but I didn't know. I was kind of naive going in. And again, the spaces in Brooklyn, as you know, are tiny. Mm-hmm. And this was 285 square feet. It was a closet. Right. So I felt, oh, that's not too bad. And whenever I think, oh, it's tiny, I can make it work, you know, and I just went for it.
So when did you decide to move back to the West Coast?
We moved back in, 2008, I think. We moved back at the end of school for Derek, and I had decided that while I liked living in New York, the pace was really making me go a little crazy.
Yeah, I can do that.
It was just getting very anxious about what I did and didn't have. And I kind of miss my family. You know, my whole family's back in California. So we decided to move back, and I ended up opening a second store with Lisa Congdon, who I had met through the first Rare Device, and that was super fun.
And how did you approach the West Coast store differently than the East Coast store?
Well, it was bigger, for one, and so we had a dedicated art gallery in it, and the neighborhood was a little bit different, and I had more connections at that point in general, so it was really fun to put together something that felt like the previous one, but also had Lisa's sensibilities, too, and then having all of the support from the people she knew, because she's really, you know, embedded in the San Francisco community, we had great support for that store.
That's great. And what did the sort of bringing in that like serious fine art gallery component to things, how did that change the shop or sort of the clientele that you were working with?
We definitely made sure to have monthly shows, and that's pretty quick turnover. But that always meant, you know, something fresh for people to look at in the neighborhood, always a reason to come in. We would have a good opening party for each one. And we tried to keep the art varied enough so a different crowd would come in all the time, too. And it just kept things lively.
So how did you decide to, you eventually sold the store. Talk about that transition and how you chose what you're going to do next.
Oh, wow. the store, you know, we had gotten to a point where we were both getting really busy with other things. So Lisa's business as an artist was really taking off, and she had less time to focus on the store. And I had a baby, and I had less time to focus on the store. And so we were finding that we loved it, but we were ready to do something else and do our side projects as full-time projects. And so we found a great new owner and sold the store. And I'm very happy to say that it's doing wonderfully right now.
That's good. I love to hear that any brick and mortar store, especially the one that started off with such a strong following, is still doing well, and not just surviving, but doing really well. I want to talk about the in-between stuff, in between Rare Device and Makeshift, which is what we'll spend the whole second half of the show talking about. But you were doing retail consulting, and you started doing, which was probably one of my favorite things you do, which is you were teaching these like business boot camps, essentially, where you were teaching people how to open shops, how to run a business. And you were teaching these not just on the West Coast, but on the East Coast as well. What was very loud noises happening in our office? Anyway, we'll ignore them and move on. Where did you make that transition? And like, how did you decide to start teaching people, not just in person, but you were writing articles for tons of different blogs that were just kind of, you were sharing so much really rich business advice with everybody.
I think what happened is after we sold the business, I had to decide what to do. And
in addition to raising a small child.
Oh, yeah, there's that. So I had Ivo, but a lot of time to think about, well, what parts of Rare Device did I enjoy the most? What can I keep? And that ended up being working with makers and working with store owners and helping them understand each other a little bit better, because there's such a big disconnect right now, and that's where most of the problems come from and all the questions come from. So helping makers learn about wholesale more, learn about how to have a good relationship with a retailer, and then vice versa, we know for the retailers where to find these really great new vendors that would match their style, and how to work with a smaller maker than maybe they were used to.
Were there any sort of surprising feedback or things that you learned from teaching those classes and kind of being involved with the next generation of potential store owners?
I think what happened is between the time of opening Rare Device and then selling it, the retail landscape had changed quite a bit. And where people learned about you as a maker, where people learned about you as a store owner had completely flipped because of things like Etsy, but also Twitter and Tumblr and everything else. Suddenly you had to be much more aware and savvy with your social media, which didn't even exist, you know, back then. It was just, it's great because it does level the playing field in many ways. You can build a lot of exposure for yourself, but you have to know how to do it and you have to dedicate the time. And for people who are just like, I want to make something and then you're going to come and buy it from me, right? Right? so that's no longer true, you know.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about that transition from this middle stage to what became a huge project for you, Makeshift. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I am here with Rena Tom of Makeshift, and I'm also here with Brian Boyer, who's going to join us for this part of the conversation. Brian is a very talented architect and is working with Rena on the expansion of Makeshift to the East Coast. So before the jump, we were talking about how Rena got started, and poor Rena is very tired from her red eye. But I want to ask you one quick question, because I think that fits in well to why you're on a red eye. What does the average day in the life look like for you, for someone who kind of has their hand in like six different pots at the same time? Red eyes, not a lot of sleep.
Yeah. So I have a 3-year-old and he's an early bird, and I'm not first, you know, take care of Ivo, get him out the door, open up Makeshift usually, and we open at 9. So I'm there 5 days a week, which is weird, again, because I'm not used to having a quote-unquote full-time job, and it kind of is, but I really, really love going in. And this is the first time I can probably say that about any full-time anything that I do, you know, that I'm happy to go show up and talk to people every day. So I go in and I answer questions for members and things, but I'm also giving tours to new people, fielding a ton of email, a lot of opportunities for us and for the members, handling the mailing list, doing some Twitter, doing some blogging, and then trying to figure out how to expand Makeshift Society. And so the latest thing has been thinking about coming out here to Brooklyn, because I think we have a big support base. I hope so, at least. So it's been a lot of fun dreaming, you know, even bigger, and trying to bring the vision, I guess, to more people.
Well, there's always been this like really beautiful kinship between San Francisco and Brooklyn that for as long as I can remember living here for the last decade, it seems like those two designers, groups of designers from both cities, are making very similar things that are only slightly different based on where they're coming from, but have like the same aesthetic, the same mission, and just like the same overall vibe. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between New York and San Francisco. I wanted to ask about Makeshift first, but let's talk about this since it kind of is coming up. What do you see as like kind of the primary difference between like small business and the creative community in New York and San Francisco? Because I think they get talked about as if they're the same, but to me, there are some pretty noticeable differences.
Gosh, Brian and I just talked about this over breakfast. Did we not?
A little bit.
What do you think, Brian?
I mean, I think the immediate difference, of course, is in San Francisco, there's just so much focus on technology, right? It just dominates everything there. So, you know, actually for Makeshift, it's kind of nice to be here in Brooklyn where there's not as much of a technology focus, because that's kind of more our perspective on things. Technology is important, but it's not what drives stuff.
Yeah. What about you, Rena? What about sort of just like the average business owner?
I think people in New York are more business oriented. They're more savvy and a little more, I don't know if professional is the right word, but if there is a certain task that someone says should be done, usually they're trying to do it. I feel like the people who want to open a store, for example, or even be a salesperson at a store, treats it very seriously. Yeah. And it's not just this fly-by-night, oh, I'm going to do with this while I wait for a better job, or I'm going to go to school, or, you know, something on the side. Where in San Francisco, I think people try things more. And so they might try a sales position or try a certain kind of business, but they're not approaching it in the same way. So I think the creativity and the experimentation happens a little bit more on the West Coast, but then as far as getting down to business, the East Coast gets it done.
I totally agree. Whenever I'm in San Francisco, I miss like the aggressiveness of New Yorkers. I love that sort of quality that New Yorkers have. But when I'm in New York, I really miss like the ability to just kind of try things and to be open-minded and to be a bit more laid back. And I think what separates East from West Coast for me is the way that businesses on the West Coast really start with passion, and the goal is to kind of like exist and to make it happen. And I feel like in New York, it's like to exist and then make it the number one thing in that category. And if yes, it's not the number one thing, then just screw it and stop and make something new that's the number one thing. If you can't be the best, don't do it. But I like that difference. When you're on the West Coast, what do you miss about the East Coast and vice versa?
When I'm on the West Coast, I do miss all of the people, all the friends that I made in my short time in New York. I still talk to all of you guys, and that's kind of a big deal, you know, to make friends as an adult, to make good acquaintances, people who I can network with later, but people who are genuinely my friends. I made a lot of really great friends out here, and that was super important for me because I was feeling pretty lonely. So through the store, I met so many wonderful people. And then, oh, bagels. On the vice versa, for the West Coast, I did miss when I was living out here and looking at why I wanted to go home. I guess I missed the, I don't know what you would call it. Just there's an ease about doing things. Sometimes that can slide too far down the slope and ease turns into laziness and I'm told you I'm going to meet you, but I'm not going to meet you kind of thing. But at the same time, there's a little bit more room for happenstance and chance and weird things happening and getting dragged to do weird things. And I think it was a little bit more scheduled on the East Coast and just a different vibe. And then the apartment size weather thing, you know, East Coast, you meet at restaurants and bars. West Coast, you have dinner at your friend's house, like different stuff.
Well, I like that you mentioned that how sort of a big of a deal it was that you've been managed to like hold on to the friendships you made on the East Coast. Because to me, you being kind of a connector is one of the things that I associate really strongly with you. And one of your interviews I read that you said one of your greatest successes was the company that you keep. And you said, I might be wrong here, but I don't think I have a lot of enemies. And I think that's really true. And I think to me, in my head, that's what made sense that made you open Makeshift in terms of creating this environment where freelancers can come, work together, benefit from each other's experience and knowledge, and have this sort of safe, positive environment to do whatever they want to do that's in a creative field. Talk a little bit about what Makeshift is, and then I want to ask about the expansion to the East Coast.
Okay. When I started, you know, Brian and I talked about this a lot last year, too, or 2 years ago. Oh, my God, 2 years ago. I've been thinking about this a long time. We were talking a lot about what this was going to mean to people and how it was going to feel, but nothing really gelled until it was actually open and I could see relationships forming, how people were really helping each other, what kind of work they were interested in doing, where I needed to step in and where I didn't. So that was really fascinating for me. We just want to be a place where you can get your work done, whatever work that may be, or whatever fun work projects that may be too. So we cater a lot toward solos who need support, you know, but they know how to do their work. They know what they want to get done. They just need the space and time and accountability from other people in order to get that stuff done. And that's something that you miss when you stop working in an office.
So how did you decide to take, you tested this out in San Francisco. It's gone amazingly well. I feel like I've seen Makeshift in every magazine and every possible publication that I've picked up over the last year, which is fantastic. How did you decide to move to New York first?
We got a lot of requests, actually. I get a lot of email every week from people who have read an interview or seen a story and said, oh my God, this really resonates. This is what I've been waiting for. I've gotten some really emotional, crazy email, and it makes me feel so good. You know, we made a little video and we interviewed some of our members too, and the video has been really hitting people in the right spot. So Brooklyn has a big base, a big fan base, and plus because I know people here, I feel like I can get some help, and this mm-hmm. is all about helping each other. So the Makeshifts are not going to get off the ground unless people step in and help, and this community has been so, you know, welcoming and willing to step in. I've gotten lots of lots of requests from people like, anything I can do, let me know. And that's amazing.
I think that, I mean, it's touching on the fact that you've really hit onto something that's missing in the market and that the creative community needs. What does that feel like to have like come up with this idea that was just an idea in your head and it's now taken off so successfully, but has really meant so much in such a deep way to so many people who are like your peers? Do you ever stop to think about that? Probably not.
It's too scary to think about, really. It is, because now I have a responsibility for a lot of people's happiness, basically, which is a goal. But when you start achieving that goal and then other people want it, it's kind of a big mission, you know?
Brian, tell us a little bit about, if you're thinking about the East Coast makeshift, is it going to be any different than the West Coast? Or are you guys hoping to set up just like a slightly different version of the San Francisco?
Yeah,
original.
Again, you know, like Rena was saying, it's a great minute for these questions because we were just talking about all of this over breakfast. I mean, I think our feeling is that the East Coast is probably a slight bit more professionally oriented than the West Coast space, but we want it to still be casual. So what we're trying to do is find a sweet spot between, you know, some of the co-working spaces that are very business oriented, even give you the kind of amenities of a business, mm-hmm. like a mailing address, yeah. and things that are kind of to preserve the professional image, you know, kind of between that and then the extremely community oriented, this isn't really a place for work, this is just to be with others like you.
Yeah.
We're in the middle spot. And so I think we're still trying to figure out exactly what that means here, but it does seem like a clear opportunity.
Well, you are the professional architect involved in this project. Tell us what you're thinking about in terms of the actual physical space. I love the way the West Coast shop was built out, and it has this really nice vibe between lounge and like an office. What are you thinking of for the East Coast?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it depends so much on where we end up. So at this stage, we're still looking at different spaces and really trying to make a decision about what neighborhood we want to be in. Don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm like, there's got to be some turf wars going on in terms of which neighborhood wants to be able to claim the next makeshift.
But again, I think, you know, if we look at what's happened in tech startups, you know, there's starting to be a very clear aesthetic in the tech startup offices that's trickling down into co-working spaces. I think it's easier for us to say we don't want to be that than to say what we do want to be. You know, actually, maybe an interesting argument that Rena and I were having, or discussion that we were having this morning, is whether
the fight you had at breakfast before you came in.
Well, Rena and I were both fighting against an invisible third person.
That's how we like to
because,
do it.
Yeah, that way we always win the argument. And the debate we were having is whether we should have ergonomic chairs or not. Right. So, you know, most office spaces offer extremely ergonomic chairs.
Yes.
And actually, both of us feel that having a chair that you don't want to sit in all day long is a great way to ensure that you get up, that you walk around, which is good for your back and your health, but also good for meeting other people. So, you know, that's the kind of territory that we're looking at now is, again, what's the kind of balance between having a place where people can and do want to do work,
yes.
but also making it with our own flavor.
It's interesting. I've never really thought about it from that perspective, but that's really cool because you are trying to build a place that's in between. It's a place that's encouraging conversation and collaboration. And if you're sitting in a very well-designed chair that encourages you to never sit up and do anything else, it doesn't exactly encourage you to get up and talk to the people that are across the room.
Yeah, I think if you want a cheap, flexible desk and that's all you care about, there are probably other people who do that better than us. If you want a place where you can do your work, and that there's a community who will support you to do your work, that's what Makeshift excels at.
I want to know, before we end, what are both of your essential business survival kits? If there are a couple things you have to have with you, because you both travel a lot for work, what are the essential items you have to have with you, whether that's like an iPhone or some sort of object or emergency packets? What are the, like, three or four things that you guys always have to have with you?
You're the pro traveler.
Oh, man.
Earplugs.
Advil all the time. I don't wear earplugs. My camera, my business is, you know, speaking, basically. So the camera is essential, and Keynote, and headphones.
That's a lot in your bag.
And a suitcase with four wheels. Absolutely essential suitcase with four wheels.
Okay. Oh, secret. Okay. My phone charger. And I don't know. I don't really have a kit. I don't travel that much, but maybe I'll start to. So having a cool place to stay in New York is kind of high on my list. I'm going to try a crazy app called Hotel Tonight. because I haven't found a room yet.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, I'm going to let you go and get some sleep, and you guys can catch up. Thank you so much, Rena and Brian, both for being
here.
Thank you. For everyone listening, you can check out Makeshift Society at makeshiftsociety.com. You can check out Rena at renatom.net, and you can check out Brian's work at brianboyer.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.